Hello, everybody out there. This is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, which you can find on this platform wherever you're watching, which includes the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio, as well as my own Facebook, YouTube, VK, Twitch, LinkedIn, and Twitter accounts. And we broadcast many weekdays, generally some kind of an interview broadcast. I'm doing most Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, although not this Friday, but most Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. in London, 7 p.m. in Berlin, although the time is going to change in London a week earlier than here, so all you British people can watch out for that next, at the end of this month. I don't know what time we'll be broadcasting there. It'll be an hour off from what it usually is for a week. And then it all goes out as a podcast. If you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform. And today, I am pleased to bring you somebody I first met at a gig many, many years ago in Texas, and who I have since seen around frequently, or at least I used to see around frequently when I used to tour in the U.S. More often, which, of course, started happening a lot less before the pandemic hit. But since the pandemic hit, of course, I don't tour at all. And so as people who have been watching this show for a while are aware, I started this show basically to have some contact with other adults, other than my wife. And the other adult we're talking to today in San Marcos, Texas, is Dave Waugh, and who I, as I mentioned, first met at a gig many, many years ago. And Dave is also one of the things that distinguishes you, Dave, from all the other people I've ever known who has ever come to one of my gigs, or that I even know, is that you worked for many, many years as a police officer. And I have to say that you're the only cop I'm actually friends with, and I just thought this would be I've thought you would be a fascinating person to talk to, because your experiences as a police officer were in many ways very different from many other people's experiences, and I just wonder if we could start with just talking about your background and how you how you ended up becoming a cop in the first place, and what happened to you in 2001. I know it's a long story, and you just feel free to take some time with it, but I thought some background would be a great place to start.
Sure. I grew up in Braintree, Massachusetts, which is south suburban Boston, Massachusetts, and a son of a high school chemistry teacher, middle class neighborhood upbringing. And one of the things that was typical of at least the area that I grew up in, or my parents, or the time that I grew up in the 60s, is I remember early on, my folks talked about, if you're ever lost, or if you need help and we're not here to help you, find a police officer. A police officer is gonna be there to help you. And that's the way we were brought up. Cops were the folks that helped people. And it was not a adversarial role in any way, which was very different later on. I had shared an office with a fellow sergeant in the police department who grew up on the west side of San Antonio, the son of a single mom, and very different. We talked to him about, what were the cops like when you grew up? Oh, they were not our friends. They were the bad guys. But again, very different the way we were brought up as kids. And later on, I'd often wanted to go into law enforcement, but I'm 5'7". And in the 60s, if you were going to be a cop, most places had, a 5'11" or so height requirement. I also wore glasses. So it was not to be. I eventually ended up going off to school. Was in the Marine Corps Reserve while going to college. Graduated from Texas A&M, became a Marine Corps officer, served a number of years, and then got out, came back to Texas. Ended up really wanted to return to public service, which is, you know, that's why I went into the service. Was you're brought up that by a school teacher, public service is good. It's what we do. So I had served in the military and hoped to and had the opportunity to go back into law enforcement, and ended up back in law enforcement. And the reason why I went back in was to help people. And that, now maybe that's idealistic, maybe that's...
Those are the doves, by the way, for listeners who we can't see them on screen, but you have pet doves in the room there. They're making those lovely noises, which as long as people know what they are, they're probably less distracting, because it's not like a woman crying in the background. It's a dove. You know, it sounds like it could be either, you know, sometimes. Please continue.
So ended up, things changed, you know, the height requirements went away with, the realization that women were okay to work as cops. And, I ended up in a smaller department, which did not have the uncorrected vision requirements that I assume have gone away now with LASIK vision correction. Mm. I was proud to serve and proud to help. And that was what I saw my role as being. Had some really great assignments. We started off the bicycle patrol in downtown San Marcos, which was a fantastic assignment, the way I ran that program, which I think is different than the way some departments may run their downtown patrols. I saw that as, you know, a throwback to when I was a kid, officer friendly. My job was to work in the downtown and make it a safe, happy place for people to come down and enjoy themselves at the downtown businesses, at the downtown bars. San Marcos is a home of Texas State University, so there's a huge student population here.
It's basically a fairly well-off college town. Having been there just a few times, it has the feel of a college town. I don't know if there's a lot of pockets of poverty or something, but it seems it's generally has the vibe of a college town with it sort of.
Yeah, dominated by the there, I would not say that it would be well off, but it is, you know, most of the jobs are in the service industry. We've got a major outlet mall here, the interstate that runs in between San Antonio and Austin runs right through here. We're about 30 miles outside of Austin, so really almost a suburb.
But is it the kind of town where when you first went into policing and wanted to actually help people, and like your experience was growing up in the suburbs of Boston in Braintree, this is also like one. I do this show on Tuesdays, Fifth Estate Live, and it's put out by an anarchist magazine that's been in existence since the 1960s. And my producer for the show is Peter Werby, longstanding anarchist from Detroit, and he lives in a town in the suburbs of Detroit where, but you know, by his own admission as an anarchist, he has to say all the cops are really nice people, and they seem to be just doing a good job in that little suburb, being nice, supportive, helpful people, and you know, keeping people safe and busting the occasional burglar or whatever. But mm-hmm. it's such a radically different experience with policing than so many other people have in society. And I wonder, like, so, but when you went into it at first, it was basically a positive experience. You felt like you were basically doing good and not being, I mean, keep on telling more about what happened in 2001. Your political realization around national and global politics at that time, did that have any impact on things locally for you?
I think it did. I don't know if it's maybe to a large extent. Around that time, I had let me back up. I had decided around the 10-year mark in law enforcement that, you know, I'd like to do something different. You know, there's the politics of the organization and the, arresting people for having a little bit of weed was not what I came in to do. That's not the helping people. That's not being the hero. So I went back to school, got my master's in public administration, and the usual assumption would be, well, you'll go on to be a police chief somewhere, maybe a city manager. No. What I hoped to do was to go into urban planning. Urban planning really interested me. I had worked downtown with the downtown patrol. When I was down there, I was invited to be a member of our Main Street board. I had was active with the downtown association, and I enjoyed that. Was awakened to the appeal of a downtown urban area, urban planning, with all of its positive aspects, not urban renewal.
No, but making, creating an urban setting that's really good for people, for humans to live in. Huh? It's another sort of angle in terms of public service, really, and as well as a fascinating, thing to be involved with from a sort of design standpoint. And so many interesting things about urban planning, I think.
And at about that time, my wife and I came up to Portland, Oregon. Looked around up there and said, boy, I'd love to live in Portland, Oregon. It reminds me a lot of Boston in a lot of ways, only with better weather. Mm-hmm. And that had tremendous appeal, and the urban planning aspects with the urban growth boundary, all of these forward-looking things at that time for urban planning really appealed to me. It discovered the Hawthorne district, even decided, hey, that's where I want to live. I want to live out there. Unfortunately, you realize soon that urban planners don't get paid much. They expect you to have and the interest was not going to go into a high paid profession, but if you work as a police officer, you own your home in Texas, and you think that you're going to move up to Portland, Oregon, and buy a house in the Hawthorne district for what you sold your home in Texas for, it's not going to happen. And you're going to start off in a planning office as a planning tech, expect you to have a planning degree, a planning be a certified planner. It just didn't work out at that time, and that's okay. Ultimately, things worked out, but stayed the career in law enforcement. But again, back to got the degree in public administration and was exposed to the academic world again, and transitioned from being a solid Republican. Based on all of the nonsense that the sales literature for the Republican Party at that time, when I was growing up and being an officer in the Marine Corps, and then looked at bigger issues, broader issues, and realized that no, there's more to life than what the Republicans are selling, and really changed the way I thought about things. And my eyes were opened to both issues of people trying to live in a society that's not very helpful to them, and even world injustices, whether it be as a t-shirt says, what's going on with Palestine. It just was an awakening, and thought of things quite differently.
And still, that was around what time? That was, you said, in the 80s or 90s? When?
No, that change was when I went back to school for my master's degree, which was in, I graduated in 2004 after, I think, 6 years part-time in the program. It started in about 98.
Mm-hmm.
When I was working downtown, and so had that transition, and I also was promoted to sergeant at about that time. So that was interesting, in that I could bring these views to the table as the leader of a platoon,
And then people would, they would sort of respectfully listen to you and then go do other things. I mean, it sounded like I didn't get the impression that you necessarily were able to convince other cops on the force of your political views. Or how did those discussions actually go? Did anybody change their perspectives on things?
If they changed their perspective, I think there may have been some incremental change in opinions. You know, I would frequently be watching YouTube videos, and you'd have, that was the time when cell phone cameras were coming into greater use, and there would be films available of cops doing stupid things in other places. And during my morning briefings or afternoon briefings or night briefings, depending on what shift I was working, I would frequently show those. And these cops would be exposed to people, other officers doing things that were stupid. And we'd discuss that. And I'd say, you know, don't be this guy. This is not what we got in to do. And there was typically, I think there was an agreement, and I don't think it was necessarily just to satisfy me and shut me up, but that, yes, we shouldn't do that. You know, one of the early on ones, I remember a videotape of it was in New York City, and they had one of those days when they were out, everyone's riding their bicycles through the streets, dressed in different costumes, and forgetting what it was called at the time, but anyhow, and the NYPD was out there, and there was a scene where there's this guy riding down the street. He was on a road bike, and he's riding along with the crowd, and you see the police officer standing out in the street. He's a young police officer, and the bicyclist is riding along, and as the bicyclists get closer, the officer starts walking towards him where he's going to pass to intercept him. And then the bicyclist is drifting away to go around him. And then all of a sudden, at the precise moment, the officer ran up and knocked him off the bike. And it was just appalling to see that. And I would show that, and, and instead, that officer was eventually, they arrested the guy on the bike, charged him with assault on the officer that assaulted him, said that he wrote up in the report that he rode his bike towards him and struck the officer, causing him to be injured, which was all nonsense. But because of the video, it came out. Ultimately, he was not charged for assault, the police officer, but he was fired and was not allowed to be a police officer anymore. And they said, well, this is, you know, he's had generations of police officers in his family, and this is a terrible punishment for him. But I remember.
But it's not really. I mean, just losing your job after you do something that could have resulted in someone dying. You know, I mean, you get knocked off a bike. If anybody's been knocked off a bike before, you know that that's a potentially fatal situation.
And, absolutely. You know. Absolutely. It's absolutely atrocious incident. But it was caught on camera. Like many of these things are. And I think that, and that's beneficial. That's good.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I remember showing this to one of our administrators, the video, and his response was, well, we didn't see what happened before the video started.
And right. That's always the response, as if there could be anything to justify what you're seeing in that video. But yeah, that's always the response, isn't it?
And, or that thin blue line, you know, it was a cop, so we got to, by default, we're going to defend what he's, what he or she has done. And no, and that's really something that needs to change in law enforcement. That's a, it's not the bad apples. It is a culture of automatic, by default, you know, the thin blue not blue line. We've got to protect each other. I remember after I retired, I asked some of the officers I'd visit with them, and I said, you know, do you really think that there's a war on police? Yes. No. And I said, no, there isn't. No. Most people are supportive, or at least not out to get you. And it's appalling that idea has become so prevalent, that there's a war on police, or you just say the Black Lives Matter, discuss the Black Lives Matter movement, and, you know, oh, that's, people get their shields up, and no, that's an anti-police organization. No, that's not what it's about. And that has to change. Now, it has to change maybe on both sides. Not as in, and when I say that, I mean, we've got to have people talking with each other. And there are good officers that are reachable out there, that should not be by default thrown into this lump group of all cops are bad.
I read recently some study of police violence, and I think it was in a particular police department somewhere in the United States, and I can't remember, but it was like that what they found was that it was a minority of officers who were committing the overwhelming majority of violence against people. And it wasn't, so in the sense, it was like to some extent the bad apple theory, like, but at the same time, what they were, the point of the study was to show that the problem was that this minority of officers committing these, the majority of the violence, were not being punished for it, and were not, basically faced no consequences. So while there were a lot of cops who would never do those things, the ones who were doing those things were just basically not facing any consequences. So the kind of these kind of constant acts of violence against people in the neighborhoods they're supposed to be policing, or, you know, well, which they are policing, just keep on going. And so it's that whole culture that you're talking about is, but then like even if that were somehow reformed, I often the one of the things they're often talking about these days, you know, not that this is new, but it's being it talked about in the news a lot more than in my lifetime, which is the question of what is it the role of the police supposed to be, and what laws are they upholding, and also who are they defending, and why are they being called rather than, say, a mental health specialist or any number of other. I mean, the role of you're often being called to do things that it's not really like a guy with a gun is not the solution for this problem here, right? What can you talk about that?
Exactly. You know, back when I was growing up, other than seeing Officer Bill, who was, you know, some departments call him Officer Friendly, that would come around, we just didn't have contact with the police department. You didn't call the police for things that people call the police for today, or dial 911 and expecting help, and the default answer for a municipality is send a police officer to everything. And when you talk about defunding police departments, which I think is really was unfortunately named, because that puts people's shields up and no, you're against cops. No, we just want to get police back doing traditional policing and handling crimes that are important. You know, we need to take a look at those laws. You know, the drug laws are insane. That whole issue needs to be decriminalized, turned over to, if it's a medical or a public health issue, that's where it can be handled, or it's maybe just not a problem. You know, someone wants, I never had problems with people that were smoking weed,
right,
beating up their wives or getting into a wreck, and you know, all of the problems were related to alcohol.
Yeah. So, what was your experience in the police force with the whole housing question, with evictions and with foreclosures, and especially since 2008? I can't remember when you retired, but you were still working at that time, right? You were probably in the thick of that. I don't know how much it was a thing around there, but.
Actually, not in the thick of it, in that that is a role played by the constables, not the municipal police departments, at least in Texas. So the people
who work, the constables work for the county, or?
Yes. So they're the ones that are serving the civil papers, the eviction notices. We had no role in that. So I can't speak to that other than we got a big problem, and there are solutions to this if we're willing to take them and look at them. You know, if you look at the number of vacant properties and then look at the number of people who need housing, or it's just such a big issue. But one that I'm not really qualified to speak on.
But as somebody with a background in urban planning, I mean, this is certainly an issue you've thought about. And as a person of the left, I would say it's certainly an issue. I mean, in terms of like the distribution of wealth in this country, in this extremely divided, stratified country where the poor keep getting poorer and the rich keep getting richer. And then, you know, you're in this position, you as a, if you're, you know, any cop is in the position of basically having to uphold that widening division of wealth in all sorts of subtle ways. Like, it's not like you're suddenly confronted with now uphold the division of wealth. It's just that one day you have to carry out an eviction. Another day you have to put somebody in prison who stole something from a house that might've been for them to be able to pay their rent. Or, I mean, it's just, it's a complex web of the kinds of crimes of poverty that are so often what you have to deal with, right?
Exactly. And but it's not anything new, although it maybe it was new, you know, that role of helping people that I was brought up to bring maybe was a fantasy that never existed. I don't know. I think that it did in a lot of places, but one of the books that I'm busy trying to work my way through is Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. And boy, nothing changes. You look
Right.
back at what was going on in the 20s and 30s, and we're doing the same thing now. Can we? I don't know what the answer is. You know, as far as law enforcement, I'd be interested to know how do Native Americans handle problems of crime in their community, or did they not have crime? Was somehow the culture was very different?
I mean, today, of course, there are police forces on the
Well,
reservations.
and that's not what I'm talking about, but the before Columbus arrived and screwed everything up, how were things handled? And because as a police officer, I am a retired officer, there are folks out there that are just crooks, criminals that are not helpful to society.
And how did they get that way? Of course, and you'd be on the front of lines of sort of running into folks who would fit that description because you're getting called to intervene with all sorts of situations. But then, I imagine, I mean, there's so many movies about this, but I imagine that it's true that being in that situation all the time must sort of give people a certain mindset where it's really easy to see society as, you know, the regular people and the criminals, right?
Exactly. And I'll make a comment on that, and then I want to return to the criminal. I remember when I was a brand new cop, one of the guys said, you know, it's important as you move on in your career, don't always hang around cops. You know, your off-duty time, you need to get out and have other friends who are not cops, because you work with cops, you're out with cops all the time. It's pretty easy. It gets to the point where you start having a mindset of it's us versus them. It's you know, cops are good, and there's people breaking laws out there as everyone else, and you don't want to go down that route. And it can become that way when, and it probably happens in every profession, maybe particularly so in law enforcement, where you get a group think, and everyone, there aren't any, there's no one to sit there and say, you know, that the emperor has no clothes. Everyone is focused on the same, running in the same direction. And I was happy to try not to be part of that mindset. And I in staff meetings, I was the one that would bring up the really crazy idea that someone from the left might bring up. But going back to the criminal aspect, I remember when I started as a police officer in 94, which I think I was 32 at the time. You know, I'd done some things before becoming a cop. But one of the guys that I met was 10 years old at the time when I met him, and he was from a tough household. You know, his dad had been in trouble with the law. His grandfather had killed someone at some point, and I'm sure he had a horrible upbringing. You know, this is why we have programs like Head Start and to help out. And all of the different social services programs are helpful to prevent people like this guy. Shortly after I met him, and I don't know if it was maybe he was 11 or 12, and I talked with him, you know, if you keep up like this, you're going to end up in prison one day. Because he was always involved in some sort of crime, stealing things or breaking things. I don't care. That was almost that would be a badge of honor to end up in prison. And later on, he was always a scourge for the neighborhood. If you live near this guy, when you would go off to work and your wife would go off to work and your kids were in school, he'd be breaking into your house and stealing your stuff. Your car would be broken into the next day. It was always a problem with this guy. And he was, and my idea of helping people, you know, when I worked downtown, we have to go down to the police department for our shift briefings. Myself and my partner, we'd always take a detour and go through his neighbor where he was living at the time. Because this knucklehead, this criminal, was creating misery and chaos for the good working people that were around him, that were low income, but they were good, solid citizens, productive members of society.
And they'd go off to work and he'd just break into their houses. And yeah. he was still a teenager at this time?
A teenager, and then he did it as an adult, and I'm sure he's spent time in prison, and I don't know if he's still alive at this point, but this was the type of person that I felt that I needed to direct my attention at. To, you know, he's busy making life miserable for these other people in the neighborhood. I'm going to go through there, and even if he just sees me, I'm going to cause some indigestion for him. But I remember one time riding through by his house, and he drives up in his car. I immediately make contact with him, tell him to get out of the car, place his hands behind his back. Why? Well, I'm arresting you. You don't have a driver's license. So I arrested him for an unlicensed driver. I created pressure on the guy that was creating pressure and unhappiness to the other people in the neighborhood. And eventually he moved on. I don't know if the landlord got tired of him living there or if he decided, you know, there's just too much attention that I'm getting from this jerk cop here, and I'll go somewhere else. So I'm sure I didn't change his ways.
Right. He just went somewhere else and maybe continued with this and making some other neighborhood miserable.
Absolutely. So those were the things that I felt were positive and the things that I needed to do to try to help out the good people. And most people, the overwhelming majority of your folks are just good people trying to survive and take care of their family, and they don't need this added aggravation of criminals stealing everything. You know, if you go out and buy a swimming pool for your kids and leave it out in your front lawn overnight, you don't want to wake up the next morning and find that it's over in this knucklehead's neighborhood and him saying, oh, no, I don't know where yours went to, but this is, we got it. Grandpa gave it to us. So now your kids have lost it. Those things happen all the time.
All the time. In this apartment complex, that happens all the time too, where I live. But is this, did you, what about the experience of sort of realizing that on some level, or either directly or indirectly, some of the crimes that people are committing are related to their being in financial need? Like, I mean, there's so many people struggling to come up with the rent every month who deal drugs and do all sorts of other things in order to come up with rent money. And maybe if they get really successful at their drug dealing, it turns into another reality. Maybe, you know, but they go to prison, they become millionaires, whatever, you know, however it goes. But of course, there's also, I mean, having lived in a community where most of the people were women on welfare with children who were dealing drugs. Back in when I lived in Olympia back in the 90s, it was like, wow, this is the reality for everybody. And in this whole community, and they're all somehow paying the rent. No, and I don't know. I couldn't even figure out how many people are doing so many drugs that there could be this many people selling drugs in the same neighborhood, you know, but they're all doing it in this neighborhood. Anyway, it was all about, covering the bills for feeding the babies. And the guys were generally nowhere on the scene. The fathers, I don't know where all the fathers were.
Yeah, like my the guy that I shared the office with. I don't know what happened, where his dad was, but he was off with his single mom, struggling to survive and raise her kids. that we've got such big issues that need to be addressed. I think that comes down to getting the right people in the right places of government to make some changes. I think that changing, going back to the war on drugs, that's just a disaster. It's a disaster for individuals. It's a disaster for law enforcement, because in many times sheriffs or police chiefs will realize that asset forfeiture is a wonderful, lucrative activity to be encouraged. And then you've got your private prisons that are making money on this, and we got to change that.
What about the forfeiture? This is a big business, isn't it? And I know very little about it, but I hear about it now and then, because you see listings for, this house was a forfeiture, and the usually the best deals if you're looking on Zillow or something. But what is this whole, there's this whole economy of people getting busted and then having their property auctioned off by police departments?
I don't work in a DA's office. I've never worked in narcotics. I don't know the specific details of it. However, I can tell you about a story. One time early on, they would train us in interdiction, highway interdiction of drug trafficking. So in Texas, you'd learn that, well, the drugs move north from Mexico or Central America. The highways is the transportation system, and money moves south. So you'd go out and they train you. So you'd be out there doing traffic stops. And I remember one day another officer stopped a car. It was shortly before Christmas. And he stopped a car out there. He was very interested in these interdiction stops. And then he was got permission to search the vehicle and ask for another unit to check by. I checked by. It's cold out. You get up there, it's a station wagon. It's got two or three generations of, I assume, Mexicans in there heading down to Mexico for Christmas, for the holidays. They'd probably been working up in Illinois or wherever. And so they had an out-of-state plate. They're traveling down there. They're cooperating with law enforcement. Who knows what they got stopped for. And the officer got permission to search, and he found inside that car a shoebox that was stuffed full of money. And he decided he was going to seize it. And he's not going to steal it from himself. He's going to seize it and take it and put it into evidence at the police department, probably several thousand dollars. Look at these people. Where are they going to get this money? Yeah, they got it from working hard for months.
Bring it home.
And now they're going back to visit their family or the rest of their family in Mexico. And, well, if they got it legitimately, they can have go to an asset forfeiture hearing and prove that it's their money and get it back. They're not going to come back to go to an asset forfeiture hearing. They're going to be happy that their interaction with law enforcement allows them to leave in one piece. Mm-hmm. and that they still have their car. They didn't, it wasn't seized from them, but they're not going to get that money back. And that money goes into the coffers of the law enforcement agency. And that's, that was part of an eye-opener to me. I said, this is crazy.
Crazy.
We're stealing these people months of labor. That they're going back to visit their family. No, this is the way we do it, and they can get it back if it's legitimate.
And the guy saying that really believes that they can get it back, or he's actually just a racist who's just saying it to cover his basic.
I think, well, there may be a little bit of both, but I think that he honestly believed that, because that's what he would do if. If he was stopped in our town, he would go to the asset forfeiture hearing and prove that he had earned that money. But
and I wonder if for a lot of cops who grew up in a comfortable suburb and they're white and they maybe had a certain set of experiences in life, it's hard for them to imagine what it's like for other people who grew up in totally different circumstances. But at the same time, so many cops are people of color as well, and I wonder. Like there's a certain culture of policing that can just get internalized, or there's just people who grew up in totally different situations who come off from the experience with the conclusion that what we need is actually more policing. Or I wonder what your experience is.
I think kind of all of the above. There definitely is a culture. And that's where I think I spoke to a little bit earlier, you know, that groupthink, the idea that, and you get a jaded view from, you know, all I'm doing all day long is handling problems, handling unhappy people. I think there's maybe a little bit more. You see some of these back the blue type programs or thoughts that maybe have some questionable or sometimes not completely for good reasons that people will have that opinion. You know, Trump is a big back the blue guy, and
of course, right? I mean, with Trump as president, the idea that that police should be anything other than racist vigilantes by profession is, I mean, why should I mean, that's what the president is telling all the cops they should be. I mean, he's encouraging it, and he's saying if you're not a cop you should do it too, and we'll drop the charges later.
Exactly. So we've got that poison going on right now that's poisoning too many people's thoughts, and hopefully that's gonna change. But
and then we'll get the guy who passed the crime bill in 1994.
Yeah,
instead.
I understand the frustrations about, and you'll have a vice president who's a former prosecutor.
Yeah.
But I really believe that. We've got to make a change, and there are, unfortunately, our system is a two-party system at the federal level. So you've got a choice of A or B, and I think B is much better. It's not the best. It's not where we ultimately want to go, but it's a maybe a baby step, but it's moving in the right direction, and it's certainly better than what we've got right now.
We're heading towards fascism, really, like real exactly. Fascism. Dave, when you think back on your time in the Marines, are there any particular reflections that come to mind in terms of what you learned about the world, and maybe later when you first realized that, or if you knew it from the childhood, that we spend half of our tax money on the military? But like, was there some point where you realized, like, gosh, this money could be used for more useful purposes?
That was a slow incremental realization that was coming along while I served. I served most of my time over on Okinawa or around Okinawa, in South Korea or Japan. And that was a fabulous experience, being exposed to a completely different culture, which was why I had, one of the reasons why I ended up going into the service was to see the world. And my dad had been in the Korean War, and I had been brought up that this is something that men do. Men serve in the military. When we'd walk around the neighborhood growing up, I could ask, well, what service was Mr. So-and-so in? And there was always an answer. They were all World War II or Korean.
That generation, yeah.
The younger ones, like my dad, were Korean War vets. But I remember while I was a officer candidate at Texas A&M, we had to review some books. And I remember one of the books that I reviewed for one of our naval science classes was Old Gimlet Eye on Smedley Butler, he was one of the highest ranking Marines and most decorated during his time, and post time in the Marine Corps went on to write The War is a Racket pamphlet, and had a very different view on military service and what he had been through. He had been, you know, been involved.
He had been the leader. He had been the one following the orders carrying out the big invasions and all sorts. And then he had this incredible conversion. It's amazing pamphlet, The War is a Racket pamphlet. Everybody needs to read that.
And that really caused some, the Marine instructor wasn't enthused with my choice of books there, but that was, you know, I've always been kind of a rebel like that wherever I was, whether it was in the service or in the police department, offering those alternative viewpoints that I think are so important. But
did you know that Smedley Butler was asked to lead a coup against the Roosevelt administration? Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah. I only just learned that recently.
So it's, you know, it's too bad that a lot of these generals, you know, they don't speak their mind and become vocal until after they've retired. But I think we've got to go back to, we've got to make some systemic changes, whether it be in things like the drug laws, or we've got to get this wealth inequity back in line. We're just so far out of line that it's causing tremendous problems, you know, and maybe those are some of the problems that we end up with someone like Trump as president, is people who were responding in inappropriate ways to these bad, terrible systemic problems that we have in our country that we need to get a hold of. And hopefully we can get a hold of them before climate change does us all in.
Yeah. Dave, in the few minutes we have left, I wonder if you just, based on anything, do you have any particular predictions for the future of the next few weeks and months in this country at this particular precipice we're on? I know from your vantage point there.
I'm really concerned about how things are going to pan out with this election. I hope this election goes in the way that Trump doesn't want it to go. And I hope that there are enough people. You know, a lot of these militias do a lot of talk But then when it comes down to it, they don't walk their talk. And I hope that's the case. I hope we don't have, now, who knows? He may end up winning the election, and then that's a whole different set of problems. But, you know, he has encouraged his militias to, or followers, to take up violent acts, and hopefully there are enough good, solid, law-abiding, focused on what is right, folks in power in law enforcement or military that are going to be able to say, no, we're, you know, the election went the way you didn't want it to go, and these people who want to play toy soldiers are not going to be very effective against the people who do it for a living. Now, we could still end up having it in Oklahoma City and things like that. We can have a lot of, sniper. There's potential for a lot of tremendous amount of violence.
Yeah. Under a Biden victory, we still would have the civil war kind of scenario potentially, and this extreme stratification of wealth and everything else. So that, yeah. Oklahoma City seems like almost inevitable.
And you know, I hope that with time, you know, people say, you know, the corporate Democratic Party is not the answer. If you look at what happened to the Republican Party, it's not the Republican Party of Ike anymore. There were some changes that came about, incremental changes, or maybe in spurts, when we had the Tea Party, and then we've got Trumpism. It's a completely different party than it used to be. Now, for the worse, but I believe that we can do that with the Democratic Party. We've got two choices. We've got A or B, in my opinion. We don't have third choice. So we need to expand the squad. It needs to be a platoon, and then a company, and then a whole Congress of folks that can think more similar to AOC and make some changes and save our country, save our civilization. Save the world civilization by doing that. But I think it has to come from within. I think that Bernie was right in that he ultimately, as an individual candidate, he lost. But I think he was on the right line, that you got to change it from within.
I love the phrase you said, expand. What was it, expand the squad? When you think of it, because is squad actually also is that a military term as well as it is? So expanding, it's smaller than a platoon.
Exactly. So those are upscale. Each of those.
I love it.
And we need to expand on that. We need
if the squad were the size of a battalion, then it would be about half the Congress. Is that?
it would be. We'd fill up the whole Congress, and that would be good. At least if you can get a majority. At least if you can get the powerful element of. So I think there's hope in that respect, because now, you know, Bernie made the mistake of calling himself a socialist, and you can say academically, well, that's where he fits in, but that has been so poisoned in the general vocabulary of your everyday people who aren't looking deeply into politics that was a bad choice of words.
And although if he didn't say, I've thought about that a lot, and I wonder if he didn't say he was a socialist, he would have to be dealing every day with people saying, you're a socialist, and he'd be having to say every day, I'm not a socialist. So it's like he either had to say one or the other, it seems to me. I mean, I don't know, in the face of the media the way it is.
Yes, because, you know, we've got, if Biden is elected, we're going to have if socialism comes to America.
Yeah, that's what they're saying about Biden, which is just stunning, you know, for the classic supporter of every free trade bill that's ever crossed his desk.
Exactly. you know, I think there's hope. I think that most people are good people. We just got to get this poison out of everyday society with us that we're dealing with, and recover from this. And it's going to be a tough recovery process, but we got to start somewhere. It's our only hope. And you know, I think with law enforcement, let's refocus on what we want cops to do. And like when I was growing up, or at least what I was exposed to, when you were taking care of legitimate problems and not all of these self-inflicted problems that we have, and it's bigger than just law enforcement. We got to change the whole society. But it starts by toning down the hostilities between groups, if we can, as best we can, and expanding the squad. To take a strong look and be educated voters and vote for these people. Now, sometimes we're going to have to take, I know it chaps people's asses sometimes. Well, we're going to take the lesser of two evils. You know, sometimes that's what life is about. You don't get to have the ideal. You got to go with incremental stand. You can get to where you're going ultimately, but we can't get there tomorrow. So
life is certainly full of lesser evil choices, huh? We make those choices every day. Yeah.
Unfortunately, yes. But you know, you get the gray hair and you start realizing that, damn, this is the way.
It's a little complicated, huh?
Yeah.
Dave, it's been a great pleasure to catch up with you a little and get to pick your brains. Thank you so much.
It's been a great visit. I hope I had something interesting to say. I don't think I'm that interesting a person, but
very interesting. And there's been a good stream of commentary that I've been monitoring now and then. But I'm not sure if. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think anybody had any particular questions, but there are definitely people interested in the discussion. And thank you.
Well, good. I'm glad to at least be interesting.
Definitely. I'm hope to see you around.
I'm glad to talk with anyone at any time. I think that's right. I think that's another part of the incremental steps of improvement.
Right. Communication.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. You're here.
Well, thanks again.
Take care, Dave. See you again.
All righty. So long.
So long. And that was Dave Waugh in San Marcos, Texas, retired police sergeant from the San Marcos Police Department. And this has been another episode of Discussions with David, which you can find archived on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio, as well as on my own Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn channels. And you can find it in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics, wherever you get your podcasts. All right. Take care, everybody. Trust your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Don't pay the rent.